I'm Caitlin.
And I'm Brianna.
Welcome back to Corrupted Beings. Now that OJ is done and past us, we are now getting on to our very first Patronus Picked episode.
Yes.
From Tanya. She has picked Al Capone.
Because I can tell you right now, that is my mom, Tanya. Love you. She's been obsessed with Al Capone my whole life, which has made me obsessed with Al Capone. I've done, like, six school projects on the man.
What's not to be obsessed with?
I mean, he is... Okay, so Al Capone's one of the most notorious gangsters in America from the 20th century. If you don't know who Al Capone is, are you sleeping under a rock?
You know what's funny is who I get him confused with sometimes?
Who?
Al Pacino. Just the names. Not the person, the
names.
I get it. The names.
I have people like that. So, Al Capone is huge. There's movies, books, TV, series, films. I already said movies, films, same thing. There's a shit ton out in our pop culture about him. His personality and his character have been used in fiction as a model for crime lords, criminal masterminds ever since his death. And he is the stereotypical image of a mobster because he wore the pinup suit, the pinstripe suits, the fedora, all of those that when you go to Party City and you see a mobster costume, it's based on Al Capone. All of it is based on this man.
And to think all this man had, this man had all this power in the 1920s. Imagine what he would be like today.
I'll get into that. Me and Tyler did the math. I had my roommate Tyler help me with some of the math numbers on how much he made back then with inflation to what he would be worth now if it was all happening right now.
I'm so excited about that.
Okay. So, Al Capone was born Alfonso Gabriel Capone on January 17th, 1899 in Brooklyn, New York. His parents were Italian immigrants, Gabriel Capone and Teresa Capone. His father was a barber and his mother was a seamstress. They were both born in, I'm going to try not pronouncing these wrong. I listened to multiple pronunciation videos. Angri, a small commune outside of Naples in the province of Salerno, Italy. Capone's family had immigrated to the United States in 1993 by a ship going through, this one I might mess up, Fiume, modern-day Rijeka, Croatia, or Rijeka, I think it's Rijeka, Croatia. A port city that was then Austria-Hungary. Is that how you say, or Hungary?
It's Hungary.
Hungary. The family settled at 95 Navy Street in the Navy Yard section of Brooklyn, New York City. Gabriel Capone worked at a nearby barbershop at 29 Park Avenue, while Al Capone was 11, his family moved to 38 Garfield Place in Park Slope, Brooklyn. I think it's cool that they have all the places they lived at. I don't know why. Al Capone was one of 8 children born to Gabrielle and Teresa. I don't know where in the 8 he fell.
Typical Italian family.
But they had a big family. This is the beginning
of his whole story.
He was a great student in Brooklyn Elementary School, but he began falling behind and had to repeat the 6th grade. He had trouble following the rules because he went to a Catholic school. He started going to a Catholic school in 6th grade, I believe. And he did not like their rules. He did not like how strict they were. It was around this time he started playing hooky a lot, and he was hanging out at the Brooklyn Docks. One day, Capone's teacher hit him for insolence. Anyway, he was talking back. She hit him. He struck her back. The principal beat him, and Capone decided to never go back to school. He never returned after that day. But by this time, the Capones had moved out of their home to a better home in the outskirts of the Park Slope neighborhood in Brooklyn. It was here that Capone would meet both his future wife, Mary Mae Coughlin, and his mob mentor, Johnny Toro.
I'm guessing Johnny Toro is important.
Oh, he's another huge gangster.
I know nothing about gangsters.
Oh,
folks.
I'm obsessed with this. Like I said, my mom. Capone worked odd jobs around Brooklyn. He worked at a candy store, bowling alley. He initially became involved with small-time gangs. He was part of the Junior 40 Thieves, the Bowery Boys, and then he joined the Brooklyn Rippers, and then the powerful Five Points gang that was based in Lower Manhattan. So, Johnny Toro. Toro was running a numbers and gambling operation near Capone's home when Capone began running small errands for him. Although Toro did end up leaving Brooklyn for Chicago in 1909, the two remained best friends. Capone started, at the beginning of it, he did run errands, but he stuck to legitimate employment, and he worked for a munitions factory as a paper cutter. In 1917, Toro introduced Capone to the gangster Frankie Yale, who employed Capone as a bartender and bouncer in the Harvard Inn in Coney Island. That is where Capone earned his famous nickname, Scarface. The story of how he got Scarface as a nickname, he was working as the bouncer at the door, and he had made an indecent remark to a woman, and her brother Frank punched Capone, then slashed him across the face, leaving 3 scars that inspired his nickname Scarface, but he hated that nickname. His main nickname, his best friends, all his closest people, called him Snorky. Don't know the story behind that, but I think that was a term for sharp dresser back then.
It was the 20s?
Snorky, yeah. Well, no, this was the, like, 1910s.
So then, yes, I believe so.
But in all his photographs, he, like, you could see it, but he tried making sure you couldn't see it in pictures of him. So he met and married May Josephine Coughlin at age 19 on December 30th, 1918. She was an Irish Catholic. And earlier that month had given birth to their first son, Albert Francis, nicknamed Sonny Capone. And his former boss and friend, Johnny Toro, was the boy's godfather. Albert, though, lost most of his hearing in his left ear as a child. I couldn't find the story of why, but since Capone was under the age of 21, his parents had to consent in writing to the marriage. By all accounts, the two had a happy marriage despite his criminal lifestyle.
Wait, so they had the kid before they got married?
Yes, they had the kid before they got married.
No, there's anything wrong with that. I was just making...
It was either in the beginning of December or late November, so they, like, got married right after. So it could have been a shotgun, but they had a shotgun marriage, but they'd known each other forever. Like,
right.
It wasn't like they were brand new to it. Yes.
Facts straight.
So now that he was a husband and a father, Capone wanted to do right by his family. He moved to Baltimore, where he took an honest job as a bookkeeper for a construction company. But when Capone's father died of a heart attack in 1920, Toro invited him to come to Chicago. And obviously Capone took the opportunity because he needed money. And Toro took over a different crime empire. I forgot. I can't say the guy's name. Colosimo, I want to say that's how you say it.
Colosimo?
Maybe. His crime empire after he was murdered on May 11th, 1920, which Capone is suspected to be involved with that murder, so Toro could take over. Capone began in Chicago as a bouncer at a brothel, where he contracted syphilis, which will later come back to bite him in the ass. He probably could have had the syphilis cured, but he never sought treatment for it.
How did he get the syphilis, though? Did he cheat on his wife?
Oh, for sure. He cheated on his wife basically the whole time, but it was the 20s. She stuck by him. They still had a happy marriage, but he was sleeping with other women on the side. He was a big gangster. He could get away with anything. I think he could get away with cheating on his wife.
Scum.
In 1923, he purchased a small house at 7244 South Prairie Avenue in the Park Manor neighborhood on the city's south side for $5,000.
That's expensive for the 10s, isn't it?
I don't know. Yeah, I would say so. Inflation, who knows? So in Chicago, Toro was presiding over a booming business in gambling and prostitution, but with the prohibition, where the sale and consumption of alcohol was not a thing anymore,
illegal.
Toro obviously focused on the new, more lucrative field, bootlegging. As a former petty thug and a bookkeeper, Capone brought his street smarts and experience with numbers to Toro's Chicago operations. He was perfect. He knew how to get away with all this shit. So Toro's like, come here, buddy.
Come here. I know you hungry.
So.
Here you go.
Nala came up to you. My dog's like, you said, come here. I am hungry.
Hi.
Okay. So Toro recognized Capone's skills and quickly promoted him to a partner. But unlike the low profile Toro, Capone began to develop quite a reputation as a drinker and a rabble rouser. My favorite word. I had to keep that in.
I love being a rabble rouser.
After hitting a parked taxi cab while driving drunk, he was arrested for the first time. Toro quickly used his connections to get him off. In 1923, when Chicago elected a reformist mayor who announced that he planned to rid the city of corruption, Toro and Capone moved their base beyond the city limits to the suburban Cicero, but a 1924 mayoral election in Cicero threatened their operations. To ensure that they could continue doing their business, Toro and Capone initiated an intimidation effort on the day of the election, March 31st, 1924, to guarantee their candidate would be elected. Some voters were shot and killed. Chicago sent in police to respond, and they brutally gunned down Capone's brother, Frank Capone, in the street.
Not Frankie.
Frankie, yeah, he got caught. He was in the middle of it. So
he got
January 25th, Capone was ambushed, leaving him shaken, but he was unhurt. 12 days later, Toro was returning from a shopping trip when he was shot several times after the attempt on his life in 1925 by rival mobsters. Toro decided to leave the business and return to Italy for good, turning the entire operation to Capone, who was only 26 at the time. Keep in mind, wow. Capone dies when he's like 42. So this all happens in a span of like 10 years. So Capone again ignored his mentor's advice to maintain a low profile and instead moved his headquarters to a plush suite in the Metropole Hotel in downtown Chicago. From there, he began to live a luxurious and very public lifestyle. He spent money lavishly, although always in cash to avoid paper trail. Newspapers at the time estimated Capone's operations generated $100 million in revenue. This is where me and Tyler did our math. That would be worth about $1.5 to $1.6 billion now.
Well, that was $100 million in 1920?
A year. $100 million a year. So that he made, if Al Capone was operating now, $1.5 billion a year.
Brie, we in the wrong dang field.
No, right? We need to go back to the 20s. We need to make our way in with Al Capone.
Hit up some Al Capone. Hey, yo, dog.
And, okay, so the new boss of the organization that took in illegal breweries and a transportation network that reached to Canada, because, you know, they needed alcohol from somewhere.
The Canadians, man.
Love them. With political and law enforcement protection, in turn, he started using more violence to increase his revenue. The press followed Capone's every move, and he was able to gain public sympathy because of his generous personality. Some even considered him a Robin Hood figure as anti-prohibition resentment grew. He worked more on the side of the people, but once he started getting more violent, his popularity went away because people are like, you were a Robin Hood, but now you're just a dick.
I mean, that tends to happen when you kill
money people. Got to his brain, but if you're making essentially $1.5 billion a year, I'd let money get to my brain too. He didn't have to worry about money at all. One time an establishment refused to purchase liquor from him.
Okay. No bueno.
And they got blown up. A lot of establishments, if they refused to buy or work with Capone, something bad would happen. They would get blown up.
So he's just a bully.
Yes. And as many as 100 people were killed in such bombings during the 20s. Rivals saw Capone as responsible for the proliferation of brothels in the city. Man had them brothels booming. He loved him a brothel.
Okay, is it just me or is that a funny word?
Brothel. Brothel.
Brothel. Sounds like you're trying to say Bratsworth. Brothel.
Okay, so Capone indulged in custom suits, cigars, gourmet food, drinks, and female companionship, clearly. Mm-hmm. He was particularly known for his flamboyant and costly jewelry. He had all the rings like you do. His favorite response to questions about his activities were, I'm just a businessman giving the people what they want. All I do is satisfy a public demand. Capone had become a national celebrity and a talking point by this time. After many attempts on his life, his close circle's lives, Capone began becoming increasingly security-minded and desirous of getting away from Chicago. As a precaution, him and his entourage would often show up randomly at one of Chicago's train depots, and buy up an entire Pullman sleeper on a night train to either Cleveland, Omaha, Kansas City, Little Rock, or Hot Springs, where they would spend the weekend in a luxury hotel under assumed names. So they would just, like, take a little week of vacay to have less chances of people coming trying to kill them. In 1928, Capone paid $40,000 to beer magnate Augustus Anheuser-Busch,
good old Bush
Senior, for a 14-room retreat at 93 Palm Avenue in Palm Islands, Florida, in Biscayne Bay between Miami and Miami Beach. He never registered any property under his name. He didn't even have a bank account, but he would always use Western Union for cash delivery, although he would never put more than $1,000. So, like, he did not want to trail it all.
Right, so where did he keep all his money?
Stacks, I don't know.
Mattress.
Mattress, for sure.
Under the
mattress. So, now we're going to talk about his most famous rivalry. It's
guarantee
a huge
you,
one.
I still don't know who that is.
Okay, well, in November of 1925, Antonio Lombardo was named the head of the Sicilian American Benevolent Society, that had been corrupted by gangsters and infuriated Joe Aiello, who had wanted the position for himself, believed that Capone was responsible for Lombardo winning, and he resented a non-Sicilian's attempts to manipulate affairs within the union. Aiello severed all personal business ties with Lombardo and entered a feud with him and Capone. So Aiello allied himself with several of Capone's enemies, including Jack Zuda, I want to say that's how you say that, who ran vice and gambling houses together. Aiello plotted to eliminate both Lombardo and Capone, and starting in the spring of 1927, made several attempts to assassinate Capone. On one occasion, Aiello offered money to the chef, Joseph Diamond Joe Espeto's Bella Cafe, Capone's favorite restaurant, to put acid in Capone and Lombardo's soup. Reports indicated that he offered between $10,000 and $35,000. Instead, the chef exposed the plot to Capone, who responded by dispatching men to destroy one of Aiello's stores on the West Division Street with machine gun fire. More than 200 bullets were fired into the Aiello Brothers Bakery on May 28, 1927, wounding Joe's brother Antonio. During the summer and autumn of 1927, so this all happened fast, like this guy wanted Capone dead.
Correct.
Aiello hired several hitmen to kill Capone, who were themselves, like, they were killed. Didn't get to them. Among them were Anthony Russo and Vincent Spazuja. This guy, Vincent.
Spazuja.
Each of whom had been offered $25,000 by Aiello to kill Capone and Lombardo. Aiello eventually offered $50,000 reward to anyone who eliminated Capone. At least 10 gunmen tried to collect Aiello's bounty, but ended up dead. Capone's ally...
Capone really did not want to die.
Oh, he did not, no. And he... Nah. Capone's ally, Ralph Sheldon, attempted to kill both Capone and Lombardo for Aiello's reward, but Capone's henchman, Frank's intelligence network, learned of the transaction and had Sheldon shot in front of the West Side Hotel, although he did not die.
Mm.
November 1927, so this is also happening in 1927. Aiello organized machine gun ambushes across from Lombardo's home and a cigar store that was frequented by Capone, but those plans were foiled after an anonymous tip led police to raid several addresses and arrest Milwaukee gunman Angelo Manto. And four other Aiello gunmen. After the police discovered receipts for the apartments in Angelo's pockets, he confessed that Aiello had hired him to kill Capone and Lombardo, leading the police to arrest Aiello himself and bring him to the South Clark Street police station. And you get this? Upon learning of his arrest, Capone dispatched nearly two dozen gunmen to stand guard outside the station and await Aiello's release. The men made no attempt to conceal their purpose there, and reporters and photographers rushed to the scene to observe Aiello's expected murder. He just sent 24 men to just stand there with machine guns in front of the police station waiting for Aiello to leave.
And the police did nothing?
Nope. They didn't hide why they were there. The police, it was corrupt. The police were working for all of them.
That's true.
When I say Al Capone ran, he basically owned Chicago.
That's crazy. The night Chicago died, man.
The night Chicago died. Daddy was a cop.
On the east side of Chicago. Back in the bad old days.
Okay, so Capone was primarily known for ordering other men to do his dirty work, but in May 1929, one of Capone's bodyguards, Frank Rio, uncovered a plot by three of his men, persuaded by Aiello, to dispose of Capone and take over the Chicago outfit. Capone supposedly beat the men with a baseball bat and ordered his bodyguards to shoot him, which was used in a scene of a movie, but there's a lot of, like, speculation on whether that really happened, because why would these three experienced men let Al Capone beat them with a baseball bat? It just doesn't make sense. It makes more sense that they were just shot dead. And in 1930, upon learning of Aiello's continued plot against him, Capone finally resolved the matter and eliminated Aiello. 2 weeks before Aiello's death, Capone's men tracked him to Rochester, New York, where he had connections through a Buffalo crime family boss, and plotted to kill him there, but Aiello returned to Chicago before the plot could be executed. On November 23rd, 1930, upon exiting one of his friend's buildings, to enter a taxi cab, a gunman in the second floor window across the street started firing at Aiello with a submachine gun. Aiello was said to have been shot at least 13 times before he toppled off the building steps and moved around the corner, attempting to move out of the line of fire, but instead he moved directly into the range of a second machine gun positioned at a third floor apartment of another apartment. It was gunned down. So that was the end of his feud that went on for so long. Capone didn't even really do anything to the guy. This guy was just mad at Capone and wanted him dead. And you can't kill Al Capone.
No, you can't. Apparently not.
The biggest thing Al Capone has been associated with and accused of, and is widely assumed to be responsible for, is ordering the 1929 St. Valentine's Day Massacre, despite the fact that he was in Florida at the time of the massacre. The massacre was an attempt to eliminate Bugs Morin, who was head of the Northside Gang, and the motivation for the plan may have been the fact that some of the expensive whiskey illegally imported from Canada via the Detroit River had been hijacked while it was being transported to Cook County, Illinois, which my family's from.
That's what I thought when you said Cook County. I was like, that sounds familiar.
Yeah. My grandma grew up in Illinois. I believe she grew up in Cook County, which is funny. They lived there during this time.
That's awesome.
So Bugs was the last survivor of the Northside gunmen. His succession had come about because of his similarly aggressive predecessors, Weiss and Vincent. They had been killed in the violence that followed the murder of the original leader. So to monitor their targets' habits and movements, Capone's men rented an apartment across from the trucking warehouse in the garage at 2122 North Clark Street, which served as Moran's headquarters. On the morning of Thursday, February 14th, 1929, Capone's lookout signaled four gunmen disguised as police officers to initiate a police raid. The fake police lined the seven victims along the wall and signaled for the accomplices armed with machine guns and shotguns. Bugs was not a part of one of the victims. Photos of the slain victims shocked the public and damaged Capone's image. Within days, Capone received summons to testify before a grand jury on charges of federal prohibition violations, but he claimed to be too unwell to attend. In effort to clean up his image, Capone donated to charities and sponsored a soup kitchen in Chicago during the Depression. The St. Valentine's Day Massacre led to a public disquiet about Thompson's alliance with Capone as a factor. Anton J. won the late mayoral election on April 6, 1931. And then after that, Capone became dubbed as public enemy numero uno.
I mean, as he should be.
Yes. Capone's image took a big spiral, and then he was just getting picked up left and right for trials, and people were trying to charge him and all that. Like, people finally started, like, genuinely hating him. Because he was, like, it was hard for them to get him because he ran the police, but then they all started, like, kind of
Turning on him.
So his first trial was on March 27, 1929, so we're going back a couple years. He was arrested by by FBI agents as he left a Chicago courtroom after testifying to a grand jury after being charged on prohibition laws. He was charged with contempt of court for faking an illness to avoid an earlier appearance, which we had talked about.
Right, but why is that FBI jurisdiction?
Because the FBI was trying to get him for anything they could. On May 16, 1929, he was arrested in Philadelphia for carrying a concealed weapon. On May 17, 1929, he was indicted by a grand jury, and the trial was held before Philadelphia Municipal Court Judge John E. Walsh. Following and entering a guilty plea by his attorney, he was sentenced to 1 year in prison. In March 1930, Capone was released, but then in April of 1930, he was arrested again.
Lovely.
On vagrancy charges while visiting Miami Beach.
What's that?
Vagrancy is like homelessness.
Oh yes, I knew that.
Yeah. The governor had ordered sheriffs to run him out of the state. Capone claimed that the Miami police had refused him food and water and threatened to arrest his family. He was charged with perjury for making these statements, but was acquitted after a three-day trial in July. Then in September of 1930, a Chicago judge issued a warrant for Capone's arrest on charges of vagrancy again. And okay, so in February 1931, Capone was tried on the contempt of court charge. In the court, Judge James Harper Wilkerson intervened to reinforce questioning of Capone's doctors by the prosecutor. So this is like him faking to be sick. So they're talking to his doctors. Wilkerson then sentenced Capone to 6 months, but he remained free while on appeal of the contempt conviction, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense.
So like, because he lied to get out of a trial that he was ill, he got 6 months in jail, but he remained free.
I mean, they were trying to get him on anything.
They were really trying to get him on anything. They were scraping for it. So, but in the wake of the St. Valentine's Day massacre, Walter A. Strong, publisher of the Chicago Daily News, asked his friend President Herbert Hoover for federal intervention to stem Chicago's lawlessness, as he said it. He arranged a secret meeting in the White House just 2 weeks after Hoover was inaugurated. March 19th, 1929, Strong joined by Frank Loesch, let me know, for the Chicago Crime Commission, and Mr. Bell made their case to President Hoover. And President Hoover, in his 1952 memoir, he stated Chicago was in the hands of gangsters, that the police were completely under their control. The federal government was the only force by which the city's ability to govern itself could be restored. At once, I directed that all federal agencies concentrate upon Mr. Capone and his allies. So they got President Hoover on it, and he was like, okay, I guess we'll go into Chicago and let's get this shit taken care of.
So that's how the FBI was able to come in and, okay.
Yeah, that's how the FBI, they were trying to get him on anything and everything because President Hoover wanted it. Because that was, he was taking over Chicago, and the only way to get Chicago back on the side of the law and look good for the president was to get Al Capone gone.
Yeah.
Yes. So, that meeting launched a multi-agency attack on Capone. Treasury and Justice Departments developed plans for income tax prosecutions against the Chicago gangster. And a small elite squad of Prohibition Bureau agents, whose members included Elliot Ness, were deployed against bootleggers to support federal efforts. Strong secretly used his newspaper resources to gather and share intelligence on the Capone outfit. The Supreme Court... So, okay, the reason they could get Capone was the Supreme Court had ruled in 1927 that income gained on illegal activities was taxable, which gave the government a strong case to prosecute Capone for tax evasion. Because remember, he didn't pay taxes because he didn't put more than $1,000 in a bank at a time. He right. kept all his money out, so he never paid taxes to the government.
Correct.
And even though it was illegal, he could still be taxed for it.
Correct.
So that's how they got him on tax evasion.
Isn't that what he was ultimately arrested for?
Yes, that is.
Not even murder?
No, because technically he never murdered anybody. He beat people up, but he had people murder people for him. Yeah, he never got his hands dirty.
He could be charged an accessory.
He could be accessory, but they didn't care about it.
If you order the hit of somebody, that's still murder.
But I'm just saying, like, right, there's no paper trail.
I understand that.
All cash, baby.
That's still a paper trail.
Yeah, but if you just hand somebody cash, there's no receipt or anything.
Paper trail. I get it.
Capone ordered his lawyer to regularize. Sorry, guys. I literally don't know how to read. Like, I'm bad at pronunciation if you can't tell.
English was that?
I don't know. He wanted his lawyer to regularize his tax position during the ultimately abortive negotiations that followed. His lawyer stated that the income Capone was willing to pay taxes for was an income of $100,000 for 1928 and 1929. So he was only claiming not paying taxes for 2 years.
Well, that's bull.
Yeah, I know. In any investigation, the government had given a letter from the lawyer acting for Capone, conceding his large taxable income for certain years. But on May 13, 1931, Capone was charged with income tax evasion for 1924 in a secret grand jury. So he was charged for tax evasion. On June 5th, 1931, he was indicted by a federal grand jury on 22 counts of income tax evasion from 1925 to 1929.
Wow.
Yeah. He was released on a $50,000 bail. A week later, Elliot Ness, told you he would come back, he had a team they called the Untouchables. They inflicted major financial damage on Capone's operations, and led to his indictment on a 5,000 violations of prohibition laws. So on top of the 22 counts of tax evasion, he got 5,000 charges of violating prohibition laws. Although the government had solid evidence against him, Capone remained confident that he would get off with a minimal sentence and struck a plea bargain to return for a 2.5-year sentence. When the judge in the case declared that he would not honor the agreement, Capone quickly withdrew his guilty plea and pleaded not guilty, and it went to trial. During the trial, Capone used the best weapons in his arsenal, bribery and intimidation, his favorite things.
As one does.
But at the last moment, the judge switched to an entirely new jury, And Capone was found guilty and sentenced to prison for 11 years. Because he had manipulated the original jury, so the judge approved a whole new jury coming in.
Oh, yeah, they're allowed to do that.
Yeah. Because Capone was so good at manipulation and bribery. And so, I mean once you start bribing the jury...
I mean, me too. Kidding.
Once you start bribing the jury, you should be able to get a new jury. Because that's not fair to the prosecution.
Well, no, but, like, and that's just, like, witness intimidation. Like, you can...
Exactly.
Yes, they have a right to their accuser, but if they have a history of intimidating witnesses, you have a right to keep a witness secret.
Exactly.
If it's in the sake of their life.
So, they charged him guilty, and he was sent to 11 years in prison. So, initially, he was sent to Atlanta U.S. Penitentiary in May of 1932 at age 33. So, keep in mind, he took charge of all this when he was 26. So,
wow,
he made basically $2 billion in a span of...
less than 10 years.
Yes. He ran Chicago. He did all this by the age of 26.
Yo, we really do be in the wrong profession.
For real. Like, oh my, he wasn't even 33 when he got charged by all this.
Imagine if we could run Florida.
Oh my God.
Oh my gosh. It'd really be Florida, man.
It'd be hard to nowadays. We'd have to go back to the 20s.
Oh, yeah.
Upon his arrival at Atlanta, Capone was officially diagnosed with syphilis and gonorrhea, because, you know, he loved him some brothels.
Them brothels always come back to bite him in the butt.
He was also suffering withdrawal symptoms from cocaine addiction.
That'll do it.
Which had perforated his nasal septum.
Ouch.
Yes. He did a lot of cocaine.
He in love with the cocoa.
He liked brothels. He liked cocaine.
I had to do that. I'm sorry.
But Capone was competent at his prison job, and he stitched soles on shoes for 8 hours a day. But when he wrote, his letters were barely coherent. So, he was seen as a weak personality. He was easily bullied by other inmates.
Because he was so out of it?
Yes, he was so out of it. He was weak. He wasn't the guy he used to be. And his cellmate was this dude, Red Rudinsky, that used to work for Capone. And he feared that Capone would have a breakdown, so he became the protector of Capone. Because he used to run errands for him. He was a very small-time criminal, but he had gotten arrested and became his cellmate.
Cute.
Yes, he had a little protector.
It's a love story. Match made in jail.
So, because of the protection, the other prisoners drew accusations from less friendly inmates and fueled suspicion that Capone was receiving special treatment. No solid evidence ever emerged.
Shocker there.
But have you seen his cell? He had lamps. He had nightstands. He had a radio. He had an actual bed. He had dressers. He had a place where he had a desk. Like, he had special treatment. Hardcore.
Well,
they slept
sure.
on, like, cots, and then they had art on the walls. He had major special treatment.
For
they were right
sure.
to assume that. But because of that, they moved Capone to a recently opened Alcatraz Federal Penitentiary off the coast of San Francisco in August of 1934.
Good old Alcatraz.
The famous Alcatraz.
No one's ever escaped there.
On June 23rd, 1936, Capone was stabbed and superficially wounded by a fellow Alcatraz inmate, James C. Lucas.
It's always the men with the middle initial.
Yeah. Why do they have to have a middle initial? He was isolated from the outside world, and he could no longer wield his still considerable influence, and he began suffering from poor health as neurosyphilis progressively eroded his mental faculties.
I love that.
Mental faculties. His formal diagnosis of syphilis of the brain was made in February of 1938, and he spent the last year of his Alcatraz sentence in the hospital section, confused and disoriented. So, a lot of the time he was in Alcatraz, he was either isolated or in the hospital because that syphilis was really getting to him. So he only served 4.5 years at Alcatraz.
Okay.
Because he served a lot of time at Atlanta. So he was only in, for how big of an impact he had on Alcatraz, he was only in there for 4.5 years, and he was sick and out of it most of the time.
Maybe they thought it was an act.
For real. He finished his term on January 6, 1939. And so he was only... he was only 40 years old when he finished his term.
Mm-hmm.
He was transferred to a federal correctional institution at Terminal Island in California to serve out his sentence for contempt of court, which was 6 months.
Okay.
He was paroled on November 16th, 1939, and after his wife May appealed to the court based on his reduced mental capabilities. because he was hella sick. So when he was released in 1939, he went to a mental hospital in Baltimore called Union Memorial Hospital. Capone was so grateful for their compassionate care that he received and donated two Japanese weeping cherry trees to Union Memorial Hospital in 1939.
How sweet.
I know, right? Don't make sense, but he did it. Also, he was kind of slipping there, so he probably thought, oh, this is perfect.
He was slipping.
He was slipping. A very sickly Capone left Baltimore on March 20th, 1940, after a few weeks of inpatient and outpatient care for Palm Island, Florida, where he bought that house.
I'm telling you, all these killers need to stay out of Florida.
I know, like, they all come to Florida.
OJ came to Florida.
Luckily, this...
Ted Bundy
Capone
came to Florida.
Capone didn't come to Florida till he was basically dying, though.
It doesn't matter.
He still stay came out. To Florida.
You still came to Florida. Stay out.
So, in 1942, after mass production of penicillin was started, like, coming to the United States, like, they started mass producing it, Capone was the first American patient treated by the new drug.
I'd die. I'm allergic.
Though it was too late for him to reverse the damage to his brain, it did slow down the progression of his neurosyphilis.
It caused damage to my brain. I'm just kidding. I just get a rash. I don't know.
So in 1946, a physician and a Baltimore psychiatrist examined him and concluded that Capone had the mentality of a 12-year-old child.
Me too.
So, like, he went from a crime boss making, like, $100,000 a year to having the mentality of a 12-year-old child. Can we talk about that? By 40 years old, he had regressed back to a 12-year-old child.
All I'm saying is stay out of brothels and stop using cocaine, man.
I know, right? Like, he really caught himself with that syphilis.
I mean, what did you expect was going to happen?
So, he spent the last years of his life in his mansion in Palm Island, Florida, spending time with his wife and his many grandchildren.
Oh, dear. Did you just say his mansion?
His mansion. Remember the one he bought for $40,000 back in the day?
Yes.
Yeah. On January 21st, 1947, Capone had a stroke, but he regained consciousness and started to improve. But then he contracted bronchopneumonia.
This man can't catch a break.
He can't catch a break. And then he suffered cardiac arrest on January 22nd. And then on January 25th, surrounded by his family, Capone died after his heart had finally failed. His body was then transported back to Chicago a week later, and a private funeral was held. He was originally buried in Mount Olivet Cemetery in Chicago. But in the 1950s, Capone's remains, along with his father's Gabrielle, his brother Salvatore, were moved to Mount Carmel Cemetery in Hillside, Illinois. And that is the end of Al Capone.
Man, all those years of people trying to kill him, he didn't die.
He
just went back to back to back.
He wasn't even 50 by the time he died. And he did all that and made all that money, and he wasn't even 50. You know, his family was set up for life. I get it, you're a mobster, so you don't want your money being tied with the federal government. That's what got him. But, like, this man really just, like...
I mean, he still should have paid taxes. Come on now.
But would you want to pay taxes when you're making that much money?
Just enough to pay... Like, you don't got to put it all... Listen, you'll get me in trouble here. You don't have to put it all in the bank. You just put enough that when you pay taxes,
but
you don't get...
But he didn't trust banks.
Okay, well...
Because he got his money illegally. He didn't want to get caught for violating prohibition laws, which he did, but...
He still did no matter what!
Well, let's be honest. He wouldn't still be alive, but he would have lived a lot longer if he didn't go to those fucking brothels.
Yeah.
If he would have stayed faithful in his marriage. This is why you stay faithful, children. You don't cheat, because then you're going to contract syphilis and die.
He's telling that teacher from Mean Girls, you'll get pregnant and die!
Chlamydia with a K. He's got gonorrhea, though. He didn't get chlamydia.
And syphilis.
Which one's treatable? Isn't chlamydia treatable?
I think they're both treatable.
He didn't die
health.
Because of the gonorrhea. He could have treated his syphilis, but he just chose not to.
It'll go away on its own.
Listen, I'm going to be honest with y'all. I don't feel bad about laughing about this man's
no,
death.
I don't.
If Al Capone wants to haunt me, I welcome it. That's all I gotta say. I want to meet the man. If he wants to haunt me, come on up in here, boy. Let's hang out. Teach me how to make some money.
Quick question. Where's the money?
Probably passed down in his family. He had grandchildren and stuff.
Okay.
He had a wife and grandchildren.
Any of them single? I'm just kidding.
I mean, they lived in Florida, so we might need to go to Facebook. You got any great grandchildren?
Uh-oh.
You got any great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren our age,
oh
maybe?
Oh my gosh, I think we're hitting the point where we recorded too much today. We're like loopy.
Just wait till tomorrow. We're not...
Oh gosh, we're not gonna get anything done.
Oh my God. Anyway, so that is Al Capone, my favorite gangster. Now you guys all know.
America's favorite gangster.
The most notorious gangster in America.
Ain't that right?
Al Capone is very interesting. I've been obsessed with him forever. I can't wait to visit his, a recreation of his cell when we go to the Alcatraz Crime Museum this summer. It's gonna be cool, 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 cool.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to post pictures of those.
Okay. So thank you for listening to our Al Capone episode.
Yeah, guys, if you have any questions or you have any case ideas, feel free to email us.
At corruptedbeingspodcast@gmail.com.
And friend us on Facebook.
Corrupted Beings Podcast.
Follow us on Instagram.
Corrupted Beings Podcast.
Follow us on Twitter.
At Beings Podcast.
And if you'd like to donate to our Patreon and get to pick specific episodes.
And get exclusive content such as our extra OJ episodes. Donate to patreon.com/corruptedbeings.
All right, guys. Thank you for listening and we will see y'all next week.
Peace out, Girl Scout.
Bye.